from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Big crippling drought across the country. We're hoping it will pass, and soon. But a strong thread of science says it may not, that we may be entering a hot, dry century. A century of drought, or mega drought, the kind that changes life for a long time. We'll look at the forecast this hour on Point. Drought and the 21st century. You can join the conversation. Has it hit you this year? What if this is just the beginning? How will we adapt? Can we? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today is Christopher Williams, Assistant Professor of Geography at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, co-author of a big new study with climate scientists from around the country analyzing the drought that struck the American West from 2000 to 2004, and co-author of an op-ed in the New York Times this weekend headlined 100-Year Forecast Drought. Christopher Williams, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
A pleasure, but this was a pretty upsetting essay that you wrote along with a couple of your fellow scientists. For those of us lay people looking at what we've just seen in this summer and in the last year and what we saw in the American West during the early part of the last decade, and you are, what, somehow pitching forward from that and saying we may be looking at a century of drought. How do you come to such a conclusion?
Right. So the way this study came about is that we observed the significant drought from 2000-2004 across Western North America. This was a five-year drought, and one of the things that makes drought especially pronounced and significant is that when it's consecutive, you can have compounding effects. And so we set out to quantify the carbon and water impacts of that particular drought. As we did so, we started to question just how significant and severe this drought was in the historical context. We started to look at paleoclimate records, and then, of course, it made sense to just see what the climate models are projecting and forecasting for the future. And so we performed a series of analyses to examine precipitation trends as forecast by the state-of-the-art climate models participating in the International Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change fifth assessment report that's coming up. And we observed that not only was this drought significant, as you noted, one of the largest droughts in the past 800 years on record for Western North America, but it's also forecast to become not just commonplace in the future, but a drought as significant as that 2000-2004 event is expected to become the wetter end of a future climatology unless we do something about greenhouse gas emissions and start adapting to that kind of change.
The wetter end? You mean this stark drought that we saw in the West in the early part of the last decade? Are you saying we could look back on it a century from now and say, well, that looks pretty good?
That could actually be, that's what the forecasts are suggesting under what we would call high emission scenarios. That is, in a sense, a business as usual in terms of fossil fuel emissions and other greenhouse gas emissions. If those come to pass, and if the climate models are as good as we believe they are as scientists at reproducing the climate patterns and the processes underlying those over the past century, then indeed, yes, that could. The climate models are suggesting that that could become the wetter end, not just the normal or the average, but in fact a wet episode.
Season in and season out, Christopher Williams, we tend to look at the weather, even when it's really bad, and say, oh, okay, yes, but let's keep in mind, you know, we all know the stories from our ancestors. Bad weather times come and they go, but you're reminding us that this is really a bad one. The worst drought you saw there in the West in 800 years, that is a long time. How do you know that?
Right. So that paleoclimate record is not something that we've produced. It's a published chronology that was the work of Ed Cook and others.
How is it created?
It's a reconstruction of past climate based on tree rings. So most trees have annular rings of growth, and those growth rings are larger in wetter years, and they're smaller in dry years. So by extracting cores from many trees and then methodically dating the rings of those of each tree, scientists are able to quantify drought and wet periods of the past. And some of these tree ring chronologies are long enough to tell us about centuries and even a millennium of the past.
So when you do that, you can see periods of what is called mega drought. What is mega drought?
Right.
And what are the factors that you see in this science that may be conspiring now to have set us up for a period, a century of mega drought?
That's right. Well, we don't actually know what exactly caused the mega droughts during the medieval period, but what is clear is that there were significantly dry periods throughout the American West in the past, and in many of them during that particular era.
So dry that you say it may have been the cause of Native American cities, civilizations, moving, changing, gone.
Perhaps collapse. That's right. Those arguments have been postulated, and this gets off topic from my particular research. But in fact, societal collapse in response to significant and prolonged drought is a possibility. Now, I'm not suggesting that we wouldn't be able to make adaptations and survive droughts, even perhaps mega droughts in such a region. But the consequences are clearly dire for water resources and a whole host of other services that ecosystems provide and things upon which we rely.
So what's happening this time that's coming together, intersecting to maybe set us up for mega drought?
Right. So there's an important transition from what we've seen in the past to what is forecast by the models. And I think this is perhaps what you were getting at. There's a lot of natural variability, and droughts do come and go. But what's forecast and what makes the forecast different is that with greenhouse gas forcings and elevated warmth in the planet, atmospheric circulation patterns, or that is winds and pressure patterns, are forecast to shift. Hadley cells get larger. The subtropical dry zone, which is a major climate zone of the world where a lot of the deserts are concentrated, is expected to expand, and dry places are expected to get still drier. And a lot of that is, in the models, forced by greenhouse push.
You're talking about human-induced climate change.
That's right.
So I just want to get this straight, because, I mean, you say this kind of casually. You're familiar with this, but you're talking about these droughts becoming the new normal, and that's pretty hard for most people to take on board. I mean, it sounds utterly devastating.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we can see it in a lot of science, not only those forecasts, but also observations. And some recent work by Jim Hansen that's been well publicized, you've probably seen that over the 20th century, the planet has in fact gotten warmer. And in their global analysis, they've seen that heat waves and hot extremes have become more common in recent decades compared to those of even just a few decades ago. The same kind of analysis can be performed with precipitation. And we can also examine the same kind of thing with Palmer Drought Severity Index. And so we see actually a general drying trend and some more frequent dry events in this particular region, Western North America. And so all of these signs are consistent with the even longer-term forecasts of what's suggested could come unless we do something right now.
There's a kind of downward spiral that gets going here when this is tough on plants, trees, crops. And you say when they don't do well, they also don't suck up that carbon. They don't do the carbon sequestration that they typically would do. And you get caught in kind of a bad to worse scenario because the plants aren't doing their job.
That's exactly right. I mean, one of the things that we see in many temperate ecosystems of the world, and certainly in North America, is that they tend to be taking up some carbon, perhaps even at an increasing rate, which is a good thing if you're concerned about elevation of CO2 and greenhouse gases. They essentially mitigate some of the emissions associated with human action today and in the past. But if droughts become more extensive, more severe, we might actually see an annulment of that important carbon sequestration benefit of ecosystems.
Let's hear from our listeners. They're paying very close attention right out on the edge of your terrain. Paul in Omaha, Nebraska is calling. Paul, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I appreciate you taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, I'm old enough to remember forecast and predictions that have kind of disappeared, you know, into the woodwork. In the late 60s and early 70s, when I was a young man, I can remember the prediction of the next ice age, that we were going to be buried in ice, and now we're talking about, you know, global warming.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that there was a period of calmness during the mid-last century, that as we emerged from that, there was a prediction that, you know, this was 40 years ago, they were saying we were going to go into a period of great extremes where the weather was going to be swinging back and forth.
Does it sound like Chicken Little to you with that perspective of years, or is that what you're...
It's a credibility issue, and I have great respect for the gentleman you're talking to and the people who work with him in that industry.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that as a consuming public who is listening to this, the credibility is undermined by the fact that a lot of these predictions come and go, and you know, the weather is is unpredictable.
Paul, let us pick it up right there. I've just got Christopher for a couple of minutes. Christopher, what about that? There's skepticism, you know, predictions come and go. There's a credibility issue. What do you say to that?
Well, sure enough, that is a significant problem, and that's something that has continued to come up. But in fact, we have begun to, and at this point feel we understand as climate scientists, as a climate community, a climate change science community, we feel like we understand what was behind that relatively cool period that you're referring to in 4 years ago. And if we can understand the mechanisms that caused predictions which seemed reasonable some years ago to actually wane and become transitioned into something else that's also mechanistically understood, I think while that's hard to consume by the public, that's the kind of awareness that we need really need to bring to the media and to the public.
Paul's in Omaha. That's right kind of on the edge of the western U.S. America that you're looking at. I mean, is what you're looking at related to the drought this summer? We're going to pull the curtain back after we let you go, but or is it something distinctly for the West?
Yeah, in fact, it's not just the West. It could extend into particularly summer precipitation declines into the heartland of the country and even into the Great Lakes region. I'm looking right now at a report suggesting that by 2080 to 2099, summer precipitation will decline not just over the West, which was the primary region we were examining, but even further into the eastern sectors of the country.
I've got you for 15 seconds. Can we adapt to this? Can we change it with our behavior now?
I think we can. There is some committed change, but we are able to make significant reductions in this kind of impact and probably avoid the worst. But now is the time to act.
If we change carbon emissions, Christopher Williams at Clark University, Worcester, Massachusetts, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about this summer's hot, dry America and whether we may be facing a century of mega drought, as at least one new report with a lot of science behind it suggests. A lot of talk about adaptation. The president talking about sort of one strand of adapting yesterday in Iowa, Council Bluffs, talked about his administration, what it will do to help farmers and ranchers affected by the country's crippling drought this summer.
I made sure my administration, led by Tom Vilsack, is doing everything we can to provide relief to those who need it. So last week we announced $30 million to help ranchers and farmers get more water to livestock and rehabilitate land affected by drought. And today we're announcing that the federal government will help livestock producers by purchasing over $150 million worth of meat and fish right now while prices are low. We'll freeze it for later, but we've got a lot of freezers.
Buy it now, freeze it for later. Just one little step in what could be, we're told, a century of hot, dry weather and a lot of required adaptation. Let's pull the curtain back here. Joining us right now from Palisades, New York, Richard Seeger, climate scientist at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, leading expert on drought. Richard Seeger, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
And from San Francisco, Michael Wehner is here, staff scientist, climate specialist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, lead author of the big report released in December by the Berkeley Lab, Projections of Future Drought in the Continental United States and Mexico. Michael Wehner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Michael, first to you. What about, we just talked with Chris Williams. He's with this group, looked at the, you know, 5 years of drought in the American West in early in the last decade and said, we may have a century like this. In fact, that may be the wet end of this century. Does that make sense to you?
Well, our projection that we made with my NOAA colleagues at the National Climatic Data Center in Asheville, North Carolina, would agree with what Professor Williams had said. In fact, our projections were slightly worse and somewhat more broadly based with across North America, particularly severe in the Southwest and on into Mexico, where the projection for the end of this century being considerably worse than the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. But I would stress that in any projection, there are a lot of caveats and a lot of uncertainties. And this kind of drought that we're talking about here, we refer to agricultural drought, which is a combination of a deficit of precipitation and high temperatures causing increased evaporation, so the soil dries out. is a specific kind of drought that can be measured a number of different ways. And the way that we did it and the way that this recent study in Nature Geoscience that Professor Williams wrote, or co-wrote, used something called the Palmer Drought Severity Index. And some of my colleagues have very severely criticized this method of characterizing drought or monitoring drought, although I would add that it is probably the most commonly used measure of drought and is part of what goes into the figure that was shown in the New York Times op-ed piece. And so I think it's important to stress that before one makes a rather extraordinary claim that the Dust Bowl is going to be the new normal, that one have extraordinary proof of that. And I think that, that this is a subject that we, because it's so important, requires that we look at it a number of different ways.
I mean, that sounds like a dissent from what Christopher Williams was telling us.
I wouldn't say that.
Well, after all, that's what he said in the lead of their essay, that these droughts are set to become the new normal. You're saying, what exactly? I mean, for us lay people, this is very unsettling stuff.
What I would suggest, and I think we all would agree, that the risk of droughts like we've seen in the last decade has increased because of the human changes to the climate system, and that risk of such severe events will continue to increase, and by large factors. Whether it becomes the normal is a very extraordinary projection, and even though my paper suggests that it's somewhat worse than what Professor Williams suggests, I would reserve a bit of caution.
Boy, we're hanging.
I'm not suggesting that that this is not the case. It's just that before I go that far out on the limb, I want to be a little more sure.
Well, look, I mean, I think it's hard for people not to hang on every glimpse of caution in that prediction because the prediction is so unnerving. I mean, Richard Seeger, come in here with your view. Here we're reading. You think this is bad? We could have a century of this coming up. And by the end of this century, what we've seen could look like wet weather compared to how dry it may be. Mega drought. It's kind of hair-raising. Now, maybe that's what we're looking at. How do you think about it, Richard?
Well, I'd like to add both a note of caution to that and a few more details. The projections from the climate models about how precipitation will change over North America are actually quite spatially variable. It's certainly true that we expect a reduction in precipitation in the southwestern part of the United States and the southern plains. But during fall and winter time, the models predict that you'll actually have increased precipitation in the northern parts of the United States. But then a reduction again in the summer. So it's not a one-size-fits-all projection for how precipitation will change across the United States. The worst impacts are going to be the largest chance of persistent year-after-year drought will be in the southwestern parts of the United States and the southern plains. I think when you get up to the very agriculturally important areas of the Midwest, for example, you're more likely to see a change with increased precipitation in the winter but reduced precipitation in the summer. So the chance of searing droughts that last for just a summer, which can be agriculturally very important, will go up. But year after year, mega drought is less likely there than in the Southwest. And another point I'd like to make is that, using the 1998 to 2004 drought, or the one we have going on now for the last 2 years, as blueprints of what global warming will bring is I think a fallacy, because both the current drought that we're experiencing now and the one that occurred at the turn of the century were largely a result of natural variability, in that they went with these La Nina conditions in the tropical Pacific Ocean, when just due to natural atmosphere ocean variability the tropical Pacific gets cold, and when it does that, it rearranges global atmospheric circulation in a way that pushes the storm track north over the North Pacific and over North America, setting the United States and Mexico up for drought. And these two droughts we've been the most, the two most recent droughts we've had over North America have been heavily influenced by the presence of La Nina conditions in the tropical Pacific. And that's true of every major drought that has occurred in the instrumental record in the United States. It's true of the Southwest drought in the 50s, and it's true of the one in the Dust Bowl drought in the 1930s.
Should that diminish in our minds the significance of man-made climate change in this?
I don't think it diminishes it, but I think, you know, what we are experiencing right now and this prior one that occurred at the turn of the century were largely the effect of natural climate variability. Now, there is an add-on effect in that in the Southwest is, I believe, gradually progressing to a drier climate as a result of global warming. And then you also have the background temperatures rising up due to increasing greenhouse gases as well. And that, by making... It's always warm during droughts because the land surface dries out and it heats mm-hmm. up because it can't cool by evaporation. It's like comparing
sure.
temperature over a parking lot to the lawn nearby.
Mm-hmm.
But because of rising greenhouse gases, it gets warmer than it otherwise would have done during a drought, and that adds some extra water stress. But I think the add-on human effect in the most recent two droughts is relatively small compared to the influence of natural variability. The natural variability is tremendous, and that's going to carry on in the future. So I think when you look out in the future, you're still going to get this succession of wet years and dry years and wet decades and dry decades, but it's going to be happening around a gradually drying mean climate, so that when droughts do occur, they will tend to be a bit worse than they otherwise would. And when you get the wet years, they're not going to be quite as wet as they otherwise would. But the way things are right now over the US and Mexico in the last 2 years, that's not going to become a new normal for the United States for a very long time to come, and probably never, because the current drought and the spatial area it covers is quite different from the spatial area we expect to get dry as a result of rising greenhouse gases.
Well, let's talk about that, if I may. Richard Seeger, stand by me. Michael Wehner, I'm sure I'm not the only one listening very closely here. And in the midst of all that, what I'm kind of hearing, and it's a lot of very interesting detail that Richard Seeger gives us, but what I hear in the heart of that is that, yes, drought and Southwest doesn't look good. Mexico, maybe. But, you know, I mean, I feel badly for Phoenix, but if it misses the breadbasket, if it's not hitting there, maybe it won't be so bad. Is that, do you hear that?
Well, yeah, but I'm not sure that's the message I would take.
Okay.
I'm actually particularly concerned about what happens south of the border of the United States.
I don't mean to be cavalier about that at all, but the U.S. breadbasket does feed a lot of the world and a lot of America.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it certainly does, Richard is right that La Nina plays a large role in modulating drought, but we should remember that La Nina will continue. La Nina cycles will continue on in the future, probably pretty much like they do. Although there could be some changes there. In the background, there is this overall warming, and so one could think about the man-made warming of the system adding some additional warming to what would in what would be a naturally occurring drought, let's say, and so the drought gets a little more severe.
A little more. I mean, we're reading
maybe
these
a lot
reports.
More. Maybe a lot more. And in fact, that's actually a really good point. Is that the amount of climate change that we've experienced so far pretty much pales in comparison to what's projected for the mid to the end of this century under these business-as-usual emission scenarios.
You know, that's not some science fiction future. That's our children's lives and maybe many of our listeners' lives.
Our younger ones especially.
Absolutely. In these studies, we're reading about the possibility of substantial western forests giving way to desert scrubland. That sounds like a pretty big deal. What about spatially in the Midwest, in the Corn Belt, where we're seeing all this withered crop right now?
Well, I think that, Richard was right in that the projections are that the northern states and into Canada will experience considerably more precipitation in the winter and spring.
Sort of beginning, north? Or starting with what, Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota?
Yeah, about the middle of Illinois, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
This is a hard thing to put, you know, where you transition between a decrease and an increase. It doesn't take, you know, much to realize that somewhere there's no change at all in the middle there. I actually would expect that projections in the summer and fall are actually pretty noncommittal for change. They're not robust at all, even under the most severe for precipitation, for the most severe emission scenarios. But they all get a lot hotter, which means that they're going to evaporate more, and that means the soil in non-irrigated farmland is going to be harder to farm, I would imagine.
Let's go to our listeners. John in Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to ask, isn't it important for the farmers merely to have a predictability of knowing from one year to the next what their weather is going to be like in order to know what to plant, whether they're going to plant winter wheat or corn or soybeans, or maybe you have to plant cotton?
Yeah, I mean, the farmers obviously are used to some variability and have grappled with that forever. But Richard Seeger, are we getting into a period here where, you know, the whole profile of what people are planting in given regions may have to change?
Well, first of all, I mean, in terms of prediction, and we can, to some extent, we can predict droughts like the current one in advance. I mean, where we can predict that is rather limited within the United States, and it's limited pretty much to the Southwest and the Southern Plains and Southeast. So much of the drought that we have been experiencing, because it did go along with La Nina conditions in the tropical Pacific Ocean, we were able to predict almost up to a year in advance, because we can predict those sea surface temperatures in advance. But the expansion of the drought up into the breadbasket is not something that was predicted, and I feel that's probably arisen from some random atmospheric variability that we just can't predict beyond the weather prediction timescale. So in terms of information that can be provided for farmers in, ahead of time to guide planting decisions, our ability there is very limited.
But we're not talking, I don't think John's question is year by year necessarily, but if you're a farmer sitting, I don't know, smack dab in the middle of the country, and you're thinking about the coming decades and what you're going to plant, what you're going to build silos for, what you're going to, you know, build your infrastructure around, do you think farmers can sort of imagine that they'll plant the same crops, or will they be moving from, I don't know, corn to cotton?
I think there probably are going to have to be decisions made like that. I mean, I would imagine, I mean, you know, I live in New York City. I'm not particularly in touch with farmers, but I would imagine that they make that decision on a growth season by growth season kind of basis. But I think the reality is that as those decisions made year by year, they will find that there do have to be changes in what they're growing and when they're growing it. So, you know, if you want to take home this picture about how climate will be changing in the breadbasket, the main thing to think of there is hotter and drier summers. That it may not be mega drought year after year after year, but if summers regularly become hotter and drier, that is going to create a water stress on crops that can be grown. So
Boy. The
normal response of American agriculture to that is to try to develop new crops that can deal with it. It's quite easy to engineer crops to deal with precipitation variations, but the temperatures are going to be going up to beyond the kind of temperatures that historically plants have been able to adjust to. So I think that's going to definitely create some technological problems for American
agriculture.
Sounds like agriculture.
It. We've got a break coming right up here. Richard Seeger, please stand by, and Michael Wehner in San Francisco. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking about the summer's hot, dry weather. Records set all over the place in this country this summer. The Northern Hemisphere just recorded its 327th 327th consecutive month in which the temperature exceeded the 20th century average. 327 consecutive months. That's something to think about. The year, this year had the fourth warmest winter on record, record-shattering high temperatures in March, huge wildfires, of course, in Colorado, western states, more than 3,200 heat records broken in June alone, and we're trying to figure out how to think about this long term. Some scientists saying that we're in for a century where drought may be bad and far more common than we've been accustomed to. Richard Seeger is with us from Columbia University, Michael Wehner from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in San Francisco, and Richard, Michael, we've got lots of response all over the map from our listeners. Here's one says, when Katrina hit, the doom and gloomers said Category 5 hurricanes would be the new normal. When the Mississippi flooded, ditto. This listener says, it's a drought, that's all. On the other hand, Tina writes to us, without the concerted will to prevent this process, the word inexorable comes to mind, and in an existentially frightening way. And we know that range of response is definitely there. The science, we're looking at it. Robert in Dothan, Alabama. Robert, thanks for calling.
Hello?
Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling because we know what the problems are. I heard on the news the other day said something about Obama's fantasy about the greening of the earth and all the solutions and that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
or the problems we have. What I'm saying is we've got to eliminate our heat generators and that sort of thing and start solutions now. Smaller cars, high-speed trains, desalinization plants, planting trees that are heat-tolerant, and all of those kind of things. We've got to start acting and acting now. You can see with NASA photographs, you can see the melting of the polar ice caps, Greenland, the glaciers melting and all of that. And with unbridled population, it's going to be even more.
What about in your backyard there in Alabama, Robert?
Yes, sir. We have had, I saw in the paper, 10 to 15 years of drought here in Dothan, Alabama, the Wiregrass region where I live. But last week and this week, we finally had some sustained rain. It's the first we've had in, months. Mm-hmm. It's so welcome. And we had a nice rain this morning, almost an hour. And it's so, so welcome.
It feels great when it comes. You're looking for a bigger response, and we hear it. And I thank you for your call, Robert. One more from right in the middle of Illinois, Springfield, Illinois. Greg is calling. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know what? I am very conflicted on this issue, and I think many, many, if not most Americans are.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line is, while we respect the scientists that are giving information to us on this issue, I think there's a feeling, gosh, do these guys have kind of a bias towards, hey, we ought to be using less carbon fuel? And I think as eminent and respectable as the science community may be on this, I think a lot of us, from watching the daily weather and the guy says it's going to rain this week or it's going to be dry for the next week, and then that prediction turns out to be untrue. One of your earlier callers talked about in the 60s, oh, there's a coming ice age, and now we're talking about there's going to be a coming drought. I just think so many of us have doubts.
I understand that conflicted feeling, Greg. Let me ask you, what would it take, I wonder? I mean, I grew up on a farm just up the road from you there, seventh-generation farm, and they've grown the same crop since 1818. Now I'm wondering what's going to grow there because the corn sure looks like hell this summer. You know, what would it take to change your mind? I don't know.
But I think a lot of us, and you look at the Farmer's Almanac, and they predict X, and Y happened. I just think that naturally all of us feel that nature is unpredictable and we don't know what's going to happen. And the problem is, in order to fix this problem,
mm-hmm.
we're going to have to impose huge pain on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the certainty is there sufficient to impose that kind of pain on ourselves.
Greg, let us pick it up right there. I think you make it very clear, and I appreciate your call. Michael Wehner, how about that? There's skepticism from right along the line, sort of where you say, you know, the drop may go maybe just that far north if it comes the way you talk about, the change conditions may come, and you hear that, as Greg says, that conflicted sense about it, the sense that scientists may be biased against carbon fuel in some way that's political, not scientific, and that the pain that required to address the climate change is so great that there's still a sort of wait and see bias there.
Well, you've just highlighted an awful lot of a lot of issues right there. I hear a lot of confusion actually in the callers. The confusion between weather and climate. Weather prediction is a short term process, and in fact, you know, weather prediction is much more accurate science now than it was even 5, 10, 15 years ago. But of course, nobody remembers when you're right. They only remember when you're wrong. And any prediction, any forecast is going to have a certain amount of failure. The climate, of course, is a different thing than climate projection is a very different thing than weather forecasting.
But that's what we're talking about today when we're talking over a century's time.
Oh, yes, yes. But a lot of the skeptical arguments will go back to errors in weather forecasting, which I would maintain aren't as big as people think they are. But projecting the climate is a different kind of thing. I think the state of the art on this has advanced a great deal in the last 10 years.
Is it firm enough to ask the kind of what Greg calls pain, that is real big changes in lifestyle that seriously addressing climate change would require?
Well, I think we're going to have a change in lifestyle one way or another. You know, either we decide we're going to consume less carbon-emitting fuels, or we adapt to the climate change that results from the burning of it. It's one or the other.
So it's coming. It's coming either way. Boy, Tim and Harlan.
Well, I mean,
yep.
You could do something about it, and the costs are large, but the costs are also large if you don't do something about it. They're different, though.
The essay that caught our eye in the Times this weekend, Richard Seeger, with Christopher Williams and co., said there's still time to prevent the worst. The risk of a multi-decade mega drought in the American West can still be reduced if we reduce fossil fuel emissions. Do you agree, Richard?
Yes, that's true. I mean, a lot of what will happen over the coming decades is already in the pipeline because of the carbon dioxide we've already put in the atmosphere and the decades that it takes for the whole climate system to respond to that. So some amount of change is utterly inevitable, but we can definitely reduce the worst of what could happen in coming decades if we actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions, or if we find a way to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and securely store it, like in geological sequestration and so on. Those are really our options. But there's it's probably the best is to adopt a mix of those, if possible. But reducing greenhouse gas emissions is definitely part of it. I would like to add that, you know, we have talked about drought in the United States, to some extent North America and agriculture. But the hydrological changes we're expecting over North America are not just occurring over North America. There's a general drying and poleward expansion of the subtropics. The warming is everywhere. So agricultural regions in Europe will also are likely to be prone to these short-term summer droughts as well. Agricultural regions in Australia could experience a progressive aridification. In the tropics, people have done projections of what rising temperatures will do to tropical agricultural productivity, and it looks extremely dire there as well. So you add up, you have a real threat here to the entire global food supply system. I mean, the one place where maybe there'll be a benefit is in Canada, where, you know, they don't have a persistent drought problem, and it's cool enough there now that warming might lengthen their growing season. But with a few, with those kind of exceptions, a few, the prognosis for most agricultural regions is in one way or another, there's increasing problems.
Mm. Jessica in Lexington, Kentucky. Jessica, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if, like he was talking about extending the growing seasons, if, you know, it would be possible that we could change, instead of trying to grow things in the middle of summer when there's a drought, that possibly we could make it a little earlier in the spring. I noticed this, we had a really mild winter, and some of the animals seem to be adapting to that or changing. I thought maybe it was a bad thing, but, like, you know, that they were coming out of hibernation earlier and things like that. Is that something we could do?
Yeah, I know what you mean, Jessica. It's like the flowers are blooming so early, budding so early, animals, birds you didn't expect to see. Michael Wehner, maybe we adapt by just sneaking our growing season in earlier. What about it?
Well, that's certainly one option. Another that Professor Seeger talked about is moving crops northward, which you know has some appeal. Except that as you get farther north, the soils aren't the same as they are in, say, the breadbasket of the United States, where the soil is particularly productive.
So are you saying you could or should, or we may end up changing the season? You may have to,
but I don't think you can expect the same kind of productivity in these soils that aren't as rich as they are in, say, Iowa.
Yeah. Tim in Harlan, Kentucky. Tim, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to ask about something they were talking about at the beginning. About adapting to the situation, and would it be possible? I mean, we talk about changing growing seasons and things like these are small changes. I'm talking about possibly large-scale public work programs, say a canal grid system. In Louisiana, where I grew up, we have a series of canals which we use to help channel floodwaters.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 70s, we had a small little drought situation going on there, and we actually noticed those same self canals could be used in reverse to kind of irrigate areas that needed water. And would it be possible? I mean, if we're looking at a 100-year situation,
yep,
or even if it's just a 50-year situation, would it be possible put us to work, get engineers and everything, and set up grid systems of canals and impoundment water facilities, desalination plants on the coast to process seawater?
I understand, Tim. You're thinking large-scale public works, maybe, as a response to this, to get the water to the soil and crops that need it. Richard Seeger, can you imagine that? Sort of, if you look down from space 75 years from now, that you may see evidence of Americans taking enormous public work steps to try and respond?
Well, I mean, it's already happened, hasn't it? I mean, since the beginning of the century, the United States has put in a system of continental plumbing that is absolutely awesome in its scale. Very few rivers within the United States manage to make it to the sea without having had significant extraction of water for human purposes.
But are we going to have to double down on that? People are talking about diverting the Mississippi.
Even bigger ideas were proposed. I mean, there was the North American Water and Power Alliance that was proposed in the 1970s, which did propose to do what the caller was suggesting, which would be of taking water from the northwest of the United States where it's wet, or even Canada, and moving it down to the arid southwest. But people jealously guard their water, and that one fell, didn't really go anywhere. And right now California is very actively engaged in moving water from its northern part to its southern part, and I think it's definitely working to look at more such transfers in the future. And other people have proposed extracting Mississippi water and pumping it uphill to the high plains, but it costs a lot to move water around. And I think that, you know, this has been done so much, and I don't actually think there's much possibility that much more of it can be done. Pretty much every dam site that is viable has already been dammed.
One more, Eric, Boca Raton, Florida. Eric, you're on the air. Thanks.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
I wanted to give a chance to actually answer your skeptic earlier when he actually questioned whether or not the scientists were actually going to have it all right and everything.
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted to actually say is, why is the scientist always being questioned when those that actually go around and actively campaign against the efforts to control CO2 and all that's going into our atmosphere,
yep,
actually have a profit motive driving them to ensure that the CO2 levels keep on rising because of the amount of fossil fuels being consumed?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. We know beyond question there have been big concerted campaigns by big energy, big oil companies, and so on to get in the middle of this debate and to raise doubts about it. There's no question about this, and yet the doubts are there. They certainly affect our politics. They affect our response. Well, I want to ask you, Michael and Richard, we've just got a couple of minutes here, but when you look at all this, Michael, I think a lot of us, well, I mean, do you hold your head in your hands? Do you say we're doomed? Do you say, how do you think about it, Michael, in a personal level?
If I thought that way, I couldn't go to work every day. I'm not ready to give up yet. I think that.
What does not giving up mean to you then?
Well, I mean, we need to offer, as scientists, I feel, mm-hmm. especially as a publicly paid scientist, mm-hmm. I feel that it's my obligation to provide the public with the best possible information we have. Some of that means that we also have to tell them what the uncertainties are as well. And our elected leaders through their elected leaders have to be able to make decisions given that there is uncertainty, but the stakes are high and the projections are dire. And some of the most dire projections we haven't even talked about, you know, hurricanes and flooding being the other side of the hydrological cycle.
Projections are dire. Richard Seeger, how do you deal with it personally with your family? I don't know if you have kids or grandkids, but when you think about them.
Well, I can't say I'm particularly optimistic. It's in terms of the practicing of the science. A few years ago, we used to look at scenarios which were characterized as middle of the road scenarios. Mm-hmm. With the new climate model simulations that are done now, I've personally and my colleagues have switched over to using one of the worst case scenarios, simply to reflect the fact that. There's nothing is being done at the international level to address greenhouse gas emissions. So let's look at, you know, what happens if we continue on the trajectory we are on. But I still think something can be done. I do take a little bit of heart from when back in the 1980s when we were dealing with stratospheric ozone depletion. The world did come together then and driven by people to address the problem of CFC emissions. And that is a problem that as a international community and active citizens, we did solve. And so we do have a precedent.
We do have a precedent, and we have scientists today saying, pay attention right now. Richard Seeger at Columbia, Michael Wehner at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Thank you to you both. Listeners, thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.